Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it! Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Marvin Gordon, a TV evangelist from New Orleans, was believed to have given photos of Swagger and a prostitute to church leaders.
I have sinned against you, my Lord.
Make a vow of faith of $1,000.
This incident on top of the Jimmy Baker sex scandal
back off.
Will not kill the televangelism industry.
Back off, devil!
I look at you, I see money.
I need the Lord to guide me.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Wrath, Part 2. Wrath, revenge, vengeance are a type of sin that can turn a gentle, God-fearing man into a hateful man with a vendetta, hell-bent on righting their perceived wrong against them to the point of irrational rage and a calculated takedown of another person. You heard in the last episode how Marvin Gorman built his ministry only to be taken down by none other than Jimmy Swaggart, who you will hear about all of his scandalous acts and incredible jealousy in this episode. We will go into full detail on how Marvin Gorman filed a lawsuit, but the aftermath for him was far more modest than Swaggart. When Gorman sued Swaggart for defamation and loss of income, he was going after a ministry second only to the Vatican in wealth. On the issue of defamation of Marvin Gorman personally, the jury concluded that damages totaled $600,000 plus $400,000 for intentional infliction of emotional distress. As to the question of damages to Marvin Gorman Ministries, they found that the conspirators were liable for $9 million. The jury came back with a $10 million verdict. Marvin Gorman never received the $10 million. In fact, he filed for bankruptcy and, exhausted, gave up pursuing the judgment in his favor. He still preached on a much smaller level. Gone were the days of private planes and Armani suits. He drove a Toyota Camry, and he and his wife, Virginia, lived in a modest home. Following the incident, Marvin Gorman would never build his church and success back to the glory, but it seemed he handled it with humbled grace and worked to rectify his wrongs. Until it was his turn for revenge. It is said that when someone seeks revenge, as opposed to just moving on with their life, they never really get over the transgression. They become obsessed with getting back at their rival. And in his vengeance, Gorman and his son Randy caught Swagger red-handed, not with hearsay, not with a woman's confession, but with a hidden camera and a police-style stakeout that caught Swagger with his pants down.
My God, give us preachers behind the pulpit that may not be too versed in geometry or geopolitics or history or Reader's Digest reports, but have lain on their faces before God until holy tears have stained their cheeks. And when they climb in that pulpit and they speak, it's like the voice of God that speaks.
So who is Jimmy Swaggart? Well, Jimmy Swaggart could be best described by the word Schadenfreude, which is a person who derives pleasure from another person's misfortune. And his years of jealous takedowns of his colleagues and even his family members was about to catch up to him. Jimmy Swaggart had all the elements that skyrocket a man from humble beginnings to one of the biggest televangelist rock stars of his day. And boy, did he live a rock star lifestyle, from owning several homes, a personal jet, late nights and days with sex workers, and a charismatic, high-energy showmanship that rivaled the antics of his cousin, the original bad boy of rock and roll, Jerry Lee Lewis. And Jimmy Lee Swagger carried the family bad boy name all the way to the top of the Pentecostal Christian world with the wealth that at the time could probably rival Beyoncé today. His revved-up sermons were also more like a rock show than a church service, with Swagger roostering his way across the stage with a proud strut, then dancing his fingers across the keys of his piano in an old roadhouse sound that matched his booming rants and Bible thrusts towards the Lord that charged his flock up into a devotional hysteria. So how did Jimmy Swagger become Jimmy Swagger? Jimmy Swaggart was born in Faraday, Louisiana on March 15, 1935, just 6 months before his cousin, rock and roll legend Jerry Lee Lewis, and a year before another cousin, country star Mickey Gilley. Like many evangelical Christians of his time, he grew up with a simple beginning, with a thirst for something more. Inspired by his grandmother, who was the first family member to be baptized, Jimmy was mesmerized by her and other church members uncontrollably speaking in tongues and giving their whole bodies up to Christ. His father also built Assemblies of God churches. But Swagger was also a mischievous troublemaker, and stories of sexual deviance, whether true or not, have swirled around the family in accusations by two different preachers. Televangelist Pat Robertson claimed, probably in an attempt to knock Swagger down a few pegs in the midst of his scandals, that the Klan was incestuous and that Jimmy had once told him that his father had watched him have sex with a prostitute and that he and his cousin, Jerry Lee Lewis, had engaged in sex with the same woman. This was echoed by Oral Roberts, another televangelist who was accused of fraud himself. He said that Jimmy had a demon in him and had confessed to sexual relations with family members as well. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade to go to work, and in 1952, at the age of 17, he married Frances Aurelia Anderson, who was 15. Neither Frances's parents nor Swaggart's wanted them to get married, especially so young and with no foreseeable income. And they knew their rebellious son would have a hard time making a living and likely didn't understand that marriage also meant getting along with another person and not putting yourself 100% above everyone else. But they were married, and it was sometimes joked about by Swagger that she was 15 and not pregnant. Swagger delivered his first sermon in front of a grocery store in Mangum, Louisiana. There were also claims that his family was very forthcoming about Jimmy's abuse of Frances in the early days of their relationship, which obviously made Frances's parents less than thrilled about the union, and they wanted her to finish high school and go to college. And obviously, domestic abuse is a serious issue and should not be excused. But Frances was no shrinking violet herself. It has been said that Frances is very much the driving force behind Jimmy Swaggart's cutthroat nature. More on that later. Like his cousins, Jerry Lee and Mickey, Swagger was a talented vocalist and musician, which placed him as an in-demand church soloist. The talent ran in the family, and Swagger was very close with his cousins, so close that he was still publicly involved with Jerry Lee Lewis when his 1957 marriage to a 13-year-old child became a matter of international scandal and concern. In the early 1960s, Swagger moved to Baton Rouge, where some of the highest and lowest points of his career would eventually take place. He started out as just a church attendee, but quickly began gaining a reputation as a fine singer of hymns, and was soon hitting the road to perform all over churches in the region, and was earning a solid living by doing so. And it was only a matter of time before Swaggart's taste for power and more money led him to the pulpit, and he began his own signature hellfire and damnation style of preaching that roused his followers into such a frenzy that he was becoming one of the most in-demand visiting evangelists in the area, and with that, his income began to climb. In 1970, Swigert met Bill Treby, an attorney practicing with the Stone Pigman firm in New Orleans, and not, incidentally, an Assembly of God minister himself. Immediately, Treby recognized Swigert's potential as a force in the denomination and began assisting him in several legal endeavors connected to Swigert's growing career. Shortly, with Treby's help, Swigert created the Jimmy Swigert Evangelist Association and began expanding his roadshow. By 1980, Swigert decided he needed a home base. He started his own church, the Family Worship Center in Baton Rouge. It was originally a small suburban congregation, but with the enormous potential for growth. He changed the name of Jimmy Swigert Evangelist Association to Jimmy Swigert Ministries, put most of his family on the payroll, and began solidifying his financial position. The small church grew rapidly, in part because his suburban location made for a congregation with disposable income, and also, and most notably, Jimmy Swigert was now a local celebrity. His first TV appearance was in 1973, and he fit the TV image of a man you can rely on. Tall, broad-shouldered, good-looking, and full of sauce. Initially, his sermons were centered around salvation and donation, but as he became more experienced, not only did his preaching style change, but his jealous competitive streak reared its ugly head. And now that Swigert had the loudest voice and the televangelist room, no one was exempt from his wrath. He began to use his platform to make biting comments about wimpy, vain, blow-dried preachers who thought they could somehow get around God's wrath with their carry-on about psychology and prosperity. He was completely in control of his evangelical career, which elevated his ego to an uncontrollable place where he continually demanded more stage time to out-showmen his cousins and perhaps had a larger audience that included an older generation, which looked down upon the antics of his rock star cousin. But Swigert, in contrast, could command the same stage, but the lyrics of the Lord replaced the lyrics of fast cars and easy women that would make the elders squirm in their seats. But boy, were they in for a big surprise. Because Swigert's prowling across the stage in the name of the Lord didn't just stop when he stepped off his riser. No, no. Jimmy Swigert would become one of the most notorious prowlers of sex workers in the Baton Rouge area and beyond. As his enterprise prospered, by 1985, Jimmy Swigert Ministries occupied close to 200 acres of property in Baton Rouge, employed more than 2,000 people, and Jimmy Swigert's Bible College boomed, and so did his TV ministry, which claimed, inaccurately, to be the only worldwide television ministry. Swigert's national status was even more prominent when he announced he ran ministries in Canada, Europe, and Costa Rica. He and his entourage traveled the world in a 727 jet provided by his company. By 1985, Swigert was one of the most powerful and wealthiest televangelists in the country. Around this time, he moved into a huge mansion, which many thought resembled a castle, complete with a moat. And this cornball narcissist probably thought he was the king of televangelism. A moat. Seriously, dude? By the mid-1980s, his broadcasts appeared on more than 250 television stations across the U.S. and pulled in about $150 million a year. His wealth also came from his best-selling records, teaching ministry, numerous books, and his merch, which included bumper stickers, t-shirts, tie clips, cufflinks, necklaces, and gold-stamped Bibles that his ministry sold on his behalf. I mean, he might as well have been the Hard Rock restaurant chain slapping his name on any product with the space that would fit it. Swigert's family, his wife Frances, and his son Donnie made up the executive board of ministry that received so many handwritten letters and mailed checks each day that the U.S. Postal Service awarded Jimmy Swigert Ministries their own zip code. When Gorman sued Swigert for defamation and loss of income, he was going after a ministry second only to the Vatican in wealth. I know I've stated that before, but I think it's major to repeat again. So, where does Jimmy Swaggart's jealousy necessarily stop? Well, certainly not with family. Now, we already know that Swaggart felt so threatened by Gorman's increasing success that he launched a smear campaign to take him down. But the cracks in his jealousy also began to show with his own family. His sermons gave special attention to adultery, pornography, which is incredibly hypocritical given Swaggart's penchant for the ladies of the night. But when he began attacking dancing and rock music in his sermons, even going after his own cousin's name showed how low he was willing to go, as he had always idolized and compared himself to his cousin Jerry Lee, but now was directly slandering his success.
Now that's our problem in the church today. You can't do that. God still demands some things of you. That's the reason tonight that there aren't 100,000 people here. It's because, and I weep many times, but I get over television and I tell the saints, leave the liquor alone. Leave the dance halls alone. Leave the Coors alone. Leave the Mogan David alone. Leave the dirty jokes alone. Leave the rock music alone. Leave the country western music alone. You see, it starts dividing. People start saying, I don't want to listen to that because they like Born to Lose.
A cousin he was so close with that after the success of Lewis's Great Balls of Fire, Jerry Lee bought Swaggart a new Oldsmobile to replace the jalopy that was providing him shaky transportation from one revival meeting to the next early in his career. Swaggart returned the favor later when he told people that Lewis was so high on drugs during an Ohio concert that he, quote, couldn't hold a tune. Swaggart says, I walked on stage and I took the microphone away from him and I said, Jerry Lee is my cousin and I love him and I think you know I love him and I've come to take him home.
You can put the country western singers in your pulpit. They've been singing in a nightclub on Saturday night and now they're going to sing in your church on Sunday morning. They'll get you a little crowd. But mister, you are luring this gospel of Jesus Christ. And you are condemning your young people almost to hell for you doing it.
Oh, you're such a hero, Jimmy. Well, what goes around comes around. And karma was knocking at his door. Old cheapskate Jimmy Billy Swaggart was about to be caught with his pants down.
That sly innuendo. They don't get up over TV and say those preachers are crazy and that Bible's stupid. They just use a little joke. Homosexuality is treated like just another form of life and living. And our young people are raised up in this aura of mind bending, and that's the effort of Satan to bend the mind. That's the reason that when a preacher like myself or these that sit here tonight, when they stand behind a pulpit over television and say these things are wrong, they're deadly, they're dastardly, they're damnable, they're dark, that we seem crazy. We seem as a man that's possessed, demoned, because everybody's doing it. And then when half the church joins in with it also, we seem like some voice out here in the wilderness somewhere. That's the reason it's the most dangerous age. Nothing is sacred anymore. Nothing is holy. The word blush, most of our teenagers don't even know what it means anymore. You hear what I'm talking about?
Deborah Murphy was the sex worker he was caught with, and you're going to hear her account of the day they were caught.
I'd mentioned to him, I said, you know, you look like Jimmy Swaggart. And he said, well, a lot of people tell me that. You know, I said that a few times, but well, he said his name was Billy, so I just went along with his game.
How long do you suppose you saw him, and how many times?
I guess around 20, 25 times. It was
1988, and Jimmy Swaggart was flying high and feeling mean, so much that he had successfully helped to take down two competitors, Jim Baker and Marvin Gorman, as well as publicly slander his closest cousin. But Gorman was about to give him a taste of his own medicine and out Jimmy for his double life. Billy, as he referred to himself to the sex workers he picked up, was at his favorite stomping grounds, the Travel Inn, with sex worker Deborah Murphy. Allegedly, this wasn't Jimmy's first encounter with Deborah. In an interview with Eileen Prose, she breaks down their relations like this. She knew pretty early on that Billy was in fact Jimmy Swaggart, and she said that when she saw his apology on TV and some of his sermons, she realized she wanted to come forward with her story to expose the real Swaggart as a totally different person when he came and saw her.
Yeah, he never spent, when I first met him, he offered me $10, and I told him no. So he come back later on that day with $20, you know, and for all he wanted to do, you know, I said, well, okay, $20, he was quick anyway, so I did it.
Now, this is a guy that at the time was speculated at his height to pull in $150 million a year. Deborah told him no at $10, so he came back later that day and offered $20. She thought if all he wanted to do was masturbate, it would probably be quick anyways, so she agreed. The next time, they went to a hotel room, and she says he sort of did the same thing. He just wanted to watch her pose naked, and he got himself off. Then, later, he would want her to use a sexual toy, and he asked her several times if she had another woman she could bring in so he could watch them both. But she didn't know anyone, so she said she never did. In this interview, the host, Eileen, asks if Jimmy was, in quotes, a normal client. And Deborah says, he was, up to a certain extent. She said that the wanting to pose was normal. A lot of guys want that. But then it wasn't normal when he allegedly wanted to get her daughter involved.
They like for you to pose and stuff, but the only thing that wasn't was when he started to get my daughter involved.
And how did he do that? He didn't really get your daughter involved.
Well, no, he wanted to. He had seen a picture of her, you know, because I always kept my room. I worked out of that same room for over a year, so I kept things there, you know. And he'd seen a picture of my kids, and he'd start off asking me questions like, he'd say, well, you have a nice family. And he would say, well, can I meet her sometime? And, you know, at first I didn't really say too much to him, you know, because I just thought he was just being nosy. And then he started asking me questions like, has she started to develop in her private parts? And I said, well, no, she's only 9 years old, you know. And then he started asking me questions like, well, can I meet her and tell her, and we tell her that he's a photographer, and maybe I'll take pictures of you, and then she'll get, you know, how do you say it?
Used to
comfortable.
Him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe participate in it. And I just, you know, when he started bringing that up, you know, I told him, hey, don't talk about my daughter.
I must note that the stuff about her daughter has never been confirmed. I am only restating what she said in an interview. The host then asks, why did she come out with all this? And Deborah says that, well, his preaching about all this stuff and pornography and saying he wanted to do it with a 9-year-old, she says, if I hadn't come out with this, he'd still be in the ministries. Deborah, I'm sorry to say he still is. Billy, the notorious John, also never tipped. He often sermonized, he regularly asked women to bring their daughters or at least naked photos of their daughters if they were initially shocked by this request, and he never wanted to touch the women. He was a hysterical germaphobe, demanding and judgmental. He barely tried to hide his identity, too. In a sweatsuit and a headband was his only disguise. Deborah Murphy admitted she had watched his crusades on television and laughed. If America only knew the hypocrisy of Jimmy's frequent visits to the Travel Inn, they would laugh right along with her. Without exaggeration, Billy was the most famous John in the New Orleans area. So what happened on that day outside the Travel Inn in 1988? Well, Jimmy walked out to his tan Lincoln in the parking lot and attempted to back out when he realized he had a flat tire. He pulled back in front of room 6 as Deborah sat on the curb watching him begin to change his tire. In Deborah's words, she was nervous he might be stopped as lots of girls had been busted that week and she didn't need the heat. As he worked, perspiring in his sweatsuit and headband, he didn't know that down the corridor in room 12, Marvin Gorman's son Randy and son-in-law Garland Bilbo, I can't get over that name, sorry, were staked out catching his every move on camera. Across the highway was a billboard that showed an open Bible, and in large letters was a verse from the Gospel of John. Quote, "Unless a man is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Your eternity is at stake." It was ironic, Deborah smirked, her eyes roving, until they rested on the window of room 12. She froze. There, in the window, was a telephoto lens draped with a black cloth. She bolted back to her room and watched through a crack in the door as, only moments later, a blue car pulled in the lot. A man in a baseball cap got out, but Deborah didn't recognize him. He barked Billy's real name as he approached the Lincoln, but Billy didn't look up. Before she closed the door of her room, she heard the stranger ask her crouching man, "Jimmy, just what do you think you're doing?" Randy and Garland had let the air out of Jimmy's tires to give Marvin enough time to drive over from his nearby church for his glory moment. So, how did Randy know that Jimmy would be at the Travel Inn on this day? Well, he was also a patron of Deborah Murphy. Although Deborah claims she did not set up Swaggart, she claims she let the cat out of the bag once on a visit with Randy Gorman, a client of hers. Randy was a police officer and a client around the same time as Swaggart. She had mentioned to Randy Gorman she was seeing Swaggart, and Randy quickly became very interested to hear more. At the time, Deborah says she didn't know that Randy was Marvin Gorman's son and likely didn't even know who Marvin Gorman was. She said Randy was just a regular client, not like a cop running a sting operation. But then he became really curious and started coming around more and calling every day after hearing about Swaggart frequenting her as well. The host then asks Deborah if Randy is unhappy with the fact that the world now knows that he was seeing her. Deborah says, "I don't know, I haven't talked to him." So obviously it was serendipitous. Both Jimmy Swaggart and Randy Gorman were clients of Deborah. And once Deborah mentioned Jimmy, Randy was all over that. She found out later that they had managed surveillance in the hotel for weeks before the bust happened. These dudes are like the Three Wise Man Mafia, the Shepherd's Nostra, the Gambinos of God. But they quickly went from tough guys to two crying crusaders of Christ, seemingly ashamed of their behavior. So this is when Marvin Gorman and Jimmy Swaggart cry together in his car. And the soap opera continued as Gorman's son took photos from the motel window. Apparently, they cried together over the loss of their friendship and how their situation had gone horribly off track. I mean, these men had been friends and shared many meals together, after all. They loved one another. Swaggart apologized, repented, asked Marvin to pray with him, and they left one another calm and confident that they could work all this out between them. Jimmy promised he would recant, admit to the lies he had told about Gorman, and use his power within the denomination to restore the minister. And Gorman assured him that the photographs were not a threat. As long as Jimmy lived up to his promise, there would be no more attacks. Gorman only had the photographs taken because if Swaggart did not finally tell the truth to the denomination, and ultimately the world, about all the lies he had told about Gorman, then Gorman would move forward with exposing Swaggart. Jimmy agreed to all, and the two estranged BFFs left the dramatic scene happy with the results. But thank God, Gorman had the photos as an insurance policy for the untrustworthy Swaggart. But repentance was not a word Jimmy may have understood. Repentance is the action of repenting sincere regret or remorse. And not only would Swaggart not live up to his word, but just a few miles from where I'm recording this right now, in Indio, California, Jimmy would be caught again. And Jimmy had the perfect bulldog PR genius of a wife, who would publicly stand beside him to protect the riches that she felt were rightfully hers. Even Gorman himself believes Francis had more of a role in his removal than Jimmy did. Larry Thomas, who worked for the Swaggarts at the height of their ministry, says that There were strangers, even, who would say Francis was the driving force behind Gorman's removal. He says people have created a persona for Francis like she was the devil behind Jimmy. She's behind anything he does. She's just a very, very strong individual who knew what she wanted, and she was very strong-willed. Threats against Jimmy were known to push her over the edge, and no one would encroach on the ratings and profits she felt were being stolen from her husband's ministry. So perhaps she was willing to turn a blind eye and fiercely protect her castle in Louisiana and lifestyle she'd grown accustomed to.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it! They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
As the months wore on, and it appeared Swagger had no intention of living up to his promise, Marvin Gorman needed to take action. He contacted Jimmy multiple times, asking whether he had confessed to the denomination. No. Gorman asked whether Jimmy had filmed an episode of his television or radio ministries admitting the lies he had told. No. Was he going to do any of the things he had promised? No. Finally, Gorman flew to Springfield, Missouri, and showed the executive leadership of the assemblies what everyone in Louisiana already knew. Swigert was a liar. A hypocrite, guilty of the sins he had accused Gorman of committing. Unlike Swigert, whose rumors and lies had no substance, except for the one instance Gorman had already confessed to, Gorman had evidence, photographs, witnesses, proof. When the denominational leaders refused to discipline Swigert, Gorman pursued justice by other means. He exposed Swigert to the world. He sued Swigert for defamation, and in the end, he vindicated himself and all of the ministers Swigert had denounced, derailed, defamed, and disgraced, Jim Baker included. When the jury awarded him $10 million in damages, Gorman walked out of the courtroom in a daze. It had been such an empty victory. He had told the truth, but at what cost? And in the infamous "I have sinned against you, my Lord" speech.
I have sinned against you, my Lord. And I would ask that your precious blood would wash and cleanse every stain until it is in the seas of God's forgetfulness. Thank you.
Jimmy Swigert did eventually go on the air in a tearful but very vague apology about his sin, with zero reference to what that sin was. On February 21st, 1988, without giving any details regarding his transgressions, Swigert gave his now infamous "I have sinned" speech. He spoke tearfully to his family, congregation, TV audience, and finally said, "I have sinned against you, my Lord, and I ask that your precious blood would wash and cleanse every stain until it is in the seas of God's forgetfulness, not to be remembered against me anymore." You just think everyone's going to forget it because you half-assed admitted to it? The camera routinely panned to Francis, nodding in proud acceptance of her man. To be fair, he does own up to this unspecified sin, even saying the media was fair to him. He doesn't say what the sin is, but, quote, he says, "I do not plan in any way to whitewash my sin. I do not call it a mistake, a mendacity. I call it a sin. I would much rather, if possible, and in my estimation, it would not be possible to make it worse than less than it actually is." These are very confusing words, Jimmy. "I have no one but myself to blame. I do not lay the fault or the blame of the charge at anyone else's feet. For no one is to blame but Jimmy Swigert. I take the responsibility. I take the blame. I take the fault." Many times I have addressed the media in a very stern manner, and I have chastised them for what I thought and believed was an error in their reporting or their investigation even. This time, I do not. I commend them. I feel that the media, both in print and by television, radio, have been fair and objective and even compassionate. Ted Koppel on Nightline, I feel, did everything within his power in going the second, third, fourth, fifth, tenth mile to make doubly certain that what he reported was at least as fair and as honest as he, the spokesman for this world-famed news program, could make it. And I thank him for his objectivity, his kindness, and his fairness. I mean, I guess he does go far in kind of taking blame, but he still doesn't say, I slept with a prostitute. With all this public attention on his sin, Jimmy probably laid low for a while, right? No. You bet your bottom dollar he did not. 1 month after the $10 million was awarded to Gorman, 1 month after the verdict against him, Swaggart was found with yet another sex worker in Indio, California. Barely a month later, desperate to rebuild his crumbling empire, this is a quote from KNBC-TV in Los Angeles, Swaggart had returned to holding crusades, always a moneymaker for him, when he was stopped on October 11th, 1991, by a police officer in Indio, California. With him in the car was yet another prostitute, Rosemary Garcia. Quote from Rosemary, for sex, I mean, that's why he stopped me. That's what I do. I'm a prostitute, Garcia told KNBC-TV in Los Angeles. He asked for sex, she said. He was shaking. In an interview with KMIR-TV in Palm Springs, Garcia said Swaggart could have avoided getting caught, but when he saw a police car behind him, he became agitated and began driving erratically, swerving his 1989 Jaguar as he tried to hide pornographic magazines that were all over his vehicle. When Swaggart was pulled over, he explained that he had pulled over to give a ride to a young woman who was standing on that side and was in the process of pulling back over when he was stopped, and the cops might have accepted that, or given him a ticket and gone on their way, except for two things. The woman was a known prostitute named Rosemary Garcia, and the driver was well-known televangelist Jimmy Swaggart. We are right on Indio Boulevard where Jimmy Swaggart pulled off with Rosemary Garcia in his car. And now I can see why old Jimmy Swaggart would have chosen this as the right place for what he wanted. It is right next to train tracks. It's like just one like motor in budgeted motel after the other, slightly under an underpass. There's like an old school truck stop that kind of looks more like a little bodega, but it says like it's like the historic truck stop on historic route 99. Wait, go back towards the motels. Let's just see what happens, like, in the parking lot of the motel. Wow. Jimmy, for preaching about, like, people, you know, getting drunk and doing sinful things and, you know, having orgies and watching porn, I mean, he really did go to the seedy underbelly. And so he must have known. I mean, he's not from Indio, California, obviously, but he must have known where to go to get what he wanted because, frankly, now I know where you go. Wow. Oh, there's an income tax, bookkeeping, payroll, and notary public. Bars on the windows there. I'm sure the ladies of the night knew when someone like Jimmy Swaggart in a brand new Jaguar was lurking around the area. They probably were all over that. But what was probably very disappointing was when they walked up to his window and found out how cheap he was. Driving around in a Jaguar, he likes to, like, lowball them and not tip. $10. Like, you have the money, sir.
You were making $150 million a year. Give these people so they don't have to do this work anymore. I'm not shaming the sex workers. I mean, there's a reason why people have to do this work. But if you're a really rich dude, pay them handsomely. I will say these motels do have the really cool old vintage signs, though. We're just driving right along the train tracks. Train tracks to our right, tons of motels to our left. Ooh, the Tropical Motor Hotel.
Tropical Motor.
Jimmy Swaggart's a tropical motor himself. I do like the mural on the historic 99 truck stop. Ooh, all is hilarious. The neon sign of the Motel 6. The first thing I just saw was, kids, stay free. I don't know if you want to bring your kids there. Oh, we got some dudes riding around on bikes. So the LA Times reported that this was an area well known for vice operations for the police department around here, looking for narcotics and prostitution dealings. I wonder if Jimmy Swaggart secretly actually did drink and do drugs. Or he just spent all his energy trying to pick up ladies. The Holiday Motel.
Oh. No visitors trespassing, loitering, or solicitation.
Oh. The sign just said, no solicitation at this motel. I don't think most... hotels or motels really have to put that up as a sign. I guess you know. So we also have barbed wire along the parking lot of this motel. Should we roll the window up? Is this unsafe? Let's put the microphone down at the very least. Okay. This is also major gang territory, FYI. Oh, that guy stared at us. Oh, he sees us. Damn it, there's an old man staring at us. Does he own it?
No big deal.
Or is he picking someone up? I'm nervous. I don't know how people do illegal things. I feel nervous.
I'm not doing anything illegal.
I know, I feel nervous just by in the proximity of it.
Yeah, definitely interesting.
I want to go into the Motel 6. Not in
the
parking lot. Yeah, oh yeah, there's some... What are these people doing just hanging outside? It is way too hot for that. There's literally people just... it's only 109. I guess it's not that bad. Oh! Guy on a bike just cheersed us with his beer.
Yeah.
What time is it? 11:26 a.m. He's riding around on a bike and just cheersed us. Maybe we shouldn't go in there.
Yeah, maybe not. There is kind of a...
I don't think they like us. Wow. Oh, I bet he cheers us because he thinks we're looking for drugs. And he wants us to know we're allowed to come in.
Yeah.
Is that how easy it is to get drugs?
Pretty much.
Wow. Now, unlike the weary preacher you saw before you confessing his sins, this time, when approached with a comment about this incident, Jimmy Swaggart said... The Lord told me it's flat none of your business. So where is Jimmy Swaggart now? Well, initially he was suspended for 3 months after the Gorman trial, but it was soon extended to a 2-year suspension due to sexual immorality, as they believed that Swaggart was not genuinely repentant. No shit. And eventually the Assemblies of God defrocked him, removing his credentials and license. But that didn't slow Cousin Swaggart down. Nope, he became an independent preacher under Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. But if you think Jimmy Swaggart's peccadilloes in the 80s permanently knocked him out of televangelism, think again. He's still pulling in millions. His house is some of the most expensive real estate in Baton Rouge, with 3 houses on the property, a gazebo, and a pond on 20 acres. And one of Swaggart's bathrooms in his cottage that he boasts is a 4-columned jacuzzi with a gold swan that spouts water into an 8-foot-long tub. He still has radio and TV programs, and his wife, Frances, hosts a TV program called Frances and Friends. His son and grandson are both in ministry, and he still has many, many real estate holdings. To give the devil his due, Jimmy Swaggart is a cunning man who will find his way out of any troubles. Before all of this scandal in 1984, his autobiography proclaimed, "There are no skeletons in the Swaggart closet," but recounted a warning from a longtime friend. There are men who can't stand prosperity. They can't stand fame. It goes to their head. They start to think they are God. And perhaps that was the downfall of both Jimmy Swaggart and Marvin Gorman. Too much, too soon, with some monkeys on their backs that they just couldn't escape. And in Swaggart's case, more so than Gorman's, a sexual thirst that he just couldn't seem to quench. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.